So today is July 28th, 2016. This is the third interview with Tracy Hahn. We're here in her office in the second floor of Memorial Library. Tracy, to help us with sound quality, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, hi. It's Tracy Hahn, H-O-N-N.
Okay, I'm going to turn it up a little closer to you.
Okay.
I don't think I introduced myself. I am Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Archives. So, Tracy, there are some things that between the second interview and third interview that came to mind, and I think we decided we want to start with that, so that some of the things that you have written down there that you want to speak to.
Okay, I'm happy to. And, you know, I did make some notes afterwards, and I'll let you make the call on whether it's risky if I get distracted by the fact that I wrote something, you know, as opposed to that just being a prompt. I don't want it to become a me reading my notes out loud to the tape recorder. But but one thing I've thought about in the way I describe my role of what I did at the press, what I do, that was helpful to me, helpful to my colleagues, it was, and because I was functioning that way, I thought, as I came to understand it more, was that I was a reference librarian for my subject area. I informally, obviously, but I don't know if other people realize the extent to which I was fielding a lot of phone calls and a lot of reference questions related. Certainly you would get a classic kind of stereotype you might have, like a student asking a printing history question. I did get those. But what I got more of were questions about particular things about printing, and especially the equipment of printing, and a lot of things that would be maybe someone who was cleaning out her grandfather's house and came across a printing press and wanted to know what it was and would send me a photograph, or I would go. I spent a good bit of time on the road going to places to look at things with people to try to help them figure out what they were. That I don't know that that's what I've done. That is indeed what I've done. So one thing I wanted to say was, as an example, so here I am, surrounded by now pretty much just archive boxes and some publications, archival boxes, and distributing those to university archives and some things that are still going up to Hamilton. So we're just down to the dregs of lists and inventories and looking at the computer and thinking of all the files I need to address on there. But last week I had two things come up that I worked on that are typical of things I have done here. And one was I had a call from a librarian at it's Mass Art. I keep having to look that up, but that's what it's called in Boston. So she's a librarian who in recent years was given a collection, their library, her institution, of historic types. And this is a named collection, the T.J. Lyons. As soon as she said it, actually I had an email first from her, but my ears really perked up because I knew we had a specimen book of that collection. I thought it had been in recent hands of a private collector, and indeed it was. And it was given, it originally came from Boston, went back to Boston, and was a gift, but this librarian was writing to me, not knowing that this collection, that I wasn't going to be here much longer, to ask about cataloging it, to ask about how do you work with a finding aid for something like that. And I know this wonderful curator at RIT, the Cary Graphic Arts Collection, Amelia Fontenelle, and also somebody at VCU who's in design there, both of whom are much more up to date on those kinds of large cataloging or even just the graphical interface that's necessary to do something like that well. And so I first called her to find out more about what she really needed as opposed to what I might want to know or say. But then I followed up with an email introduction to those people. And to my pleasure, Amelia's already written back with a huge project she was working on that's exactly this kind of thing, and wanted to encourage this librarian to get on board with her for something she's already doing. I love that. You know, that that's a deep pleasure to be able to put people together in my field who are professionals. The other thing that I've been doing, and this maybe feels almost more like a legacy project, but and it's what I think of in general. So this idea of functioning as a reference person, but as a teacher, as an artist, as a member of the library, it's been really important to me to put people together or to point to something. I felt like being able to underline was maybe the best thing we could do here. If there's a library project going on, then being able to produce some kind of printed matter that goes with it, really understanding what that project is in the first place makes all the difference in my abilities to promote it, produce something. So, but related to that, I know a good bit about the history of printmaking and graphics at UW-Madison because I went to school here, because I knew Art Hovey, because Art Hovey had me read page proofs for his book with Warrington Colescott on progressive printmaking in Wisconsin, and because of my own interest. And now, kind of like I'm old enough to have seen some of that history, so it's not just an incidental interest, right? So there's this young man I met a few weeks ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, who's a recent BFA from the art department, who was hired by Fran Myers. So she's professor emeritus of printmaking here in Taleo, who died just... I need to ask Luke about that. I'm seeing him tonight about how soon after this all happened. But so she... There is a collection of prints, a study collection of prints that you would have in any studio, any academic studio. Students at the end of the semester leave behind their work. It's like you leaving a copy of your paper, right? It's research. It's evidence. It's important to show to other students. And it's a particular kind of challenge, of course, with visual material art. So those over how many years, from Warrington, who retired, Fran, who was hired, and other studios there, there have been these collections of prints. But you have, at the same time, this turnover of faculty with new people coming. You know, retirements mean that people's study collections like this are left behind. And sometimes the institutional history and knowledge goes with them. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of the prints go with them. It's a very informal process. Fran hired Luke to clean this room and to work on these prints. Well, he spent 2 years working on this project and has this database just listing the artists, having done all this research for people who are, in many cases, unknown and maybe didn't go on in art. Others who did, this would be early examples of their first sort of nascent work in the field. He's cataloged all that. He's tried to rehouse it in something more proper. He has no budget, and he actually graduated this spring. He's back here for 2 weeks on his own dime out of devotion to the subject and trying to finish this work. So after talking with him several times, and the art department, some people are on leave or there are new faculty, some of whom are very supportive of this, but it's all been a little stochastic. Nobody's sort of just directing this project. It's happening, but the most senior printmaker sort of that generation is just retiring now. And I put someone in the art department, Jim Escalante, who's a dean in the School of Ed as well, together with Brianna Marshall, who's at Minds at UW, as a possible repository for this. It seems like the perfect place. It's probably not a thing that they've dealt with a lot before, but when I read what they do because of some rights issues related to these materials, it seems more appropriate than, you know, a UWDC kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Formerly, they couldn't really publish this material. Mm-hmm. It includes classroom notes from Fran with years of handouts prepared by students on demonstrating different techniques. And it's really that in particular, which has been scanned, is a really, it's a unique document. Mm-hmm. It's both of its time, but it's really ephemeral and kind of scary to think that that would go away because it's such an important teaching document for the future. So those are things that I've done recently that are typical of things I've done in the past. Okay. And that's what I wanted to mention. My reference questions were both on printing and printing history, but also book arts more generally. And I've worked with Lynn Kerenick, who's the Kohler Art Library Director, but she's also the curator of their collection of artist books, and that's been an important relationship in the libraries and also just, you know, supporting my own field. And it's related to that kind of being an informal reference person. And I've worked with Lynn on making purchases and also curation. We did a general review of the whole collection after Lynn was hired. Mm-hmm. I'm proud to say I was on the search and screen committee. You asked me about service for Lynn's position mm-hmm. after Bill Bunce retired. And I think I mentioned Bill Bunce in my previous interview with you, but he might have been one person that I missed really mm-hmm. talking about, who was really important to me as a student. And it says something, I think, about how important pivotal people in libraries. I mean, sometimes a person in a library saves a student's life, and Bill was one of those people for so many students because he was very attentive to a student's needs for research or things to see. Mm-hmm. But also, if you made work and took it to Bill and showed it to him, he gave you the respect of his attention. He really is a model for me on how to treat people. Mm-hmm. And he had started the artist book collection to support Walter Hamady's teaching. It's such an important, also part of this legacy related to printmaking in the art department. And then when Lynn was hired and we talked about having an exhibit of the artist book collection that would be highlights from that collection, mm-hmm. We did a full review of it. And that was such a privilege to do that. We really looked at and handled every book in that collection at the time. It's probably outgrown the ability to do that survey. And I don't mm-hmm. remember how many months. You know, we would just get together maybe once every week or so and spend a few hours looking at books, make some notes. And then, but after that, we had a lot of work done, both thinking about how she might develop that collection for the future, but then to pull from for that exhibit that we had. So that was a great exhibit to work on. And I think I said some things here that are sort of flowery, so I'm not going to read that or say it out loud about what I thought my role might be. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of fun right now that they have this show in Special Collections that's like a Greatest Hits or something. I think mm-hmm. they invited all their student curators to pull books that they love or mm-hmm. find interesting. And Robin Ryder pulled some things from the Silver Buckle Press, which is very sweet. It's a sort of feels sentimental to me right now at this time since I'm leaving soon. But she chose, among other things, a poster I did a few years ago for an exhibit they had called All Hands. And they were images of and books about the subject of hands, which is a rather broad, and it was an omnibus show. But from the poster, I printed these really gorgeous, they actually belong to me, but I loaned them. They're indexes, you know, printer's fists, those are sometimes called. So it's a pointing hand. I'm doing a pointing hand for Troy right now. Okay. But it's a left and a righty pointing towards the word all hands. But that's on it's being used as a splash right now, that image, for all these public computers. So it's really fun mm-hmm. to walk around the library right now, and every so often I get this little flash of my own work coming back at me, and it's because of that show. You asked me about something. This is a segue.
Right, the Renaissance. Was it the Renaissance?
Yeah, you said it's kind
of. I wrote down on Renaissance my of paper interest. From the last time, Renaissance of Interest. Yeah. That's all I wrote with a question mark. Yeah. So I was hoping that by saying Renaissance, like word association,
it was exactly right. No, and it's the one. You know, it's one thing I can talk about because of the privilege of simply being in a job for as many years as I have, at a particular time where I really got to see something happen in the world. That's a change. Mm-hmm. And that is around letterpress printing, the field of book arts and printing. And when I started here, I think the perception of a collection like this, generally, I really have a whistle. Mm-hmm. I see my dentist about that. Is that's interesting. It's historic. It's dead. I see how maybe that could be used. You know, you could show students how books used to be made. But the truth of the matter is that books were being made using those tools. And although I use these collections, I tried to use them to teach students that traditional story about the history of printing, and these artifacts could do that, I also knew that it was interesting that there were artists and writers and publishers who were interested in those tools that were working now. And they weren't using those tools just because they were old. why were they using those things? So that material culture, why was it being saved? What was going on with that? But at the same time, it's still, when I started, it was a little rarefied, let's say, and certainly vulnerable to that kind of perception. And students, when they looked at things, when I gave tours, they didn't know what certain things were. Most students weren't used to thinking about typefaces as having names. That's an obvious change in my life, short career lifetime. That now, if I have a group of undergraduates in here and I say to them, do you have a favorite typeface? That question presumes a whole lot of experience and a change in the world that wasn't there before their parents started using personal computers, right? Before desktop publishing, personal computers, we didn't have that kind of knowledge. So people who are over 60 coming in, their experience often might be industrial arts in high school, and it would be generally gendered, so mostly men. Mm-hmm. Older gentlemen have had some experience often with typesetting, and they've seen a type case before. Students today might or might not, but increasingly it's more common that they have. And that's because there's now a lot more people doing letterpress than there were 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that is the change that I saw from this position, more in those kinds of reference questions I was getting. More in the kind of people who were coming here. People have always come here on purpose, meaning from out of town. Mm-hmm. So I would have people call me, and I would make appointments, and I would sort of give them a nickel tour, right? Not so formal a tour if it was just one or two people. But increasingly, with the changes that we've had, these are vast. This isn't like the change in the design revolution that came about because of working with computers means that people are very sophisticated visually in ways they weren't before, and they're really interested in in printing history and printing today. And so the questions I would get are, where can I find a printing press? How can I buy this thing? How can I learn this thing? That was suddenly new. You would have in the past had a few students interested in teaching. Now you have many, many more students interested in printing. Mm-hmm. A lot of things drove it. I think computers are the main thing that have driven that. There's been, we've lived through something in the libraries that I think is really significant, and it was super hot at the beginning of the 21st century, not as au courant for discussions, but it's like the death of the book, right? Libraries are still, in fact, I think probably the reality of the struggle, sort of aftermath of those kind of, in the Atlantic Monthly discussions, are what libraries are truly dealing with now because of perception of the public, because of budgets. But at the beginning, it was sort of like, oh, books are dying, and how do we deal with this? And people often looked at the computer as a kind of, like a Luddite. There was a lot of use of that phrase, right? But I don't think that was ever what, that was never a negative that meant it was somehow computers were killing printing. Computers generated printing. Computers led to the use of digital tools, really led to this renaissance of interest in letterpress printing and printing generally, craft generally. Mm-hmm. Martha Stewart should get props always for having really cultivated an interest among all kinds of people in well-made craft, well-crafted, aesthetically considered things. And I don't know if people remember what bookstores and book design and an airport looked like in the 1970s and the 80s, but they didn't look so good. Like, buying printed matter anywhere, like in an airport, if you just like walk through an airport and it's like 1985, you'd be hard-pressed to get a sandwich or a book, right? That wasn't pretty bad. But that world's changed. I mean, we think bookstores are dying, but you go to an airport today, there's a decent bookstore there. You could find a good book, and you could find a good sandwich, too. You know, and that's all kind of, a lot of that is a change in the world that has to do with people who want well-designed things. They want goodness around them everywhere. And that, I think that's a really positive thing. I might have mentioned this to you before. I don't know if it was on or off sort of tape, but one of the oldest listservs on the internet was started by letterpress printers. And those were people who just wanted to get together and talk. That listserv is still going. There are other discussion groups that are incredibly lively. I checked this morning to see what was going on Briar Press, and that's a letterpress community of people who collect and use and sell and know about printing equipment and things. And there's a lot going on, you know, in the last few days. There are others as well, and there were some technologies that really made it possible for people to print without doing handset type, hand composition. One of the things I showed people here and taught is really a 19th century technology. In the 20th century, typesetting was mostly mechanized. The Linotype, the greatest machine in the world, was well established by the beginning of the 20th century. That was a done deal. And so commercial houses or big newspapers weren't handsetting type. We have this great film in the library. It's called Farewell, Etowan Shardlu, which is Etowinshardlu. And that is the top line of a linotype keyboard that's being referred to in those letters. That little movie, which now I think you can get online. For a while it was restricted and you couldn't. Carl Schlesinger was involved in producing it. He was a typesetter for the New York Times. But he worked on a keyboard that looks a lot unlike the QWERTY keyboard of a linotype machine. And the movie is about the last day the New York Times ran hot type, which was in the early 1980s. It's not as long ago as we think that they were still setting their type that way. For letterpress printers, one thing that's really changed is digital typesetting. And young people today don't handset their type, except for maybe some wood type experiments they might do with big material that's easy to set and print from. They are doing all of their design online. That started in the 1990s, that artists were working with, and this is related to technology in the library, that artists were working to compose and design using Adobe systems and these very early tools that were available. I think artists are always early adapters, as are librarians necessarily, to make their art. And especially people who work with text, it really offered some tools they didn't have before, obviously. Type on a curve, which will be the cliche of the 90s when people look back, is related to that. If you go back and look at a magazine today from the 1990s and look at the advertising in it, there's a whole lot of type on a curve. What does that mean? Not in a straight line, right? Letters on a big swooping curve. And that's because suddenly people could do that with digital tools, and they couldn't do it even in cold typesetting very well. If you saw that in the 1940s, somebody laid that out by hand. And did it in camera. It's a very more laborious process. And it's really evident if you know a little something about how somebody can affect that later, like, oh, everybody can do this now and it's so cool and we're all going to do it. But for artists, typesetting is the bugaboo. I mean, it's labor, for one thing. That's no surprise that the mechanical typesetting machine was so popular and successful. But the same thing goes for handset, which is what a lot of artists had done to keep letterpress alive. They had kept letterpress alive through an interest in some of the qualities of printing that comes with handset, the kind of designs that were made for it, the beauty of the impression on the sheet, all of those things. But not everybody has the money anymore or the availability of type. That is a limitation. So in 1992, I mentioned before, I think it was to Barbara Tettenbaum did this project that was an exchange with other printers, The Exquisite Corpse. And one thing that's really fun about that is seeing what each artist is doing in his or her own studio, because they're carrying those ideas over. It's not, those are apparent, right? So between that and the 97 publication we did, it's obvious that artists have started to use computers. And it's a really nice, very local, you know, discrete comparison to be able to look in those that short amount of time. Some of the artists in their notes about their prints actually refer to the system they're using. So that's also something that's very cool to look back and see just as a historic document. But polymer plates, which were a technology already around, but were a perfect marriage for people going from a digital file to, it used to be old school negative, but to some kind of output then that was electronic that went direct to a plate making process. So they were using letterpress to print their work and maybe other traditional media, but artists today who are working with text of any size, if it's a letterpress production, they're not hand setting, they're computer setting their type and then going to a plate making process. And there's a lifetime of kind of really pretty boring discussion about why that's good aesthetically or not, but it's like the horse is out of the gate on that one. And it led the less expensive and the availability just to an artist to get plates made and to put them into a system that could go on a press meant that you just had thousands of people were like, oh my God, I can't believe how liberating and wonderful this is. I think what I was going to say before about computers in general, it's definitely yes and. You know, they can... Computer, social media make it possible to be sharing your work when you're living in a small town, when you're living in a big town and you don't know anybody who does what you do. I mean, it really is revolutionary in the ability of people to share ideas and to show what they're doing with each other. But it also has really fueled... it supported, I think, an interest that was there and maybe a little nascent, and it is that people love to work with their hands. They need to make things. It's a human endeavor. It never went away. It never stops. You just see that there are certain historical trends that can be traced or roots, like, you know, the arts and crafts movement and American parallels like Dart Hunter and handmade paper. The level of interest in those comes and goes, but I haven't seen, I've been talking with my friend Jim Moran at Hamilton Woodtype and Printing Museum, whom I've known since, I guess, 2008. Like, when's it gonna stop? Because his museum and the Silver Buckle also started to have, or they much more than we, I mean, they're an international place now for interest in printing, but people keep coming. They keep coming. And one of my first years up there for a conference, there was a guy from Australia whose destination was Two Rivers, Wisconsin. That means something's going on in the world, you know? He's not the only international visitor. It was kind of amazing. To see that happen. So that's a big change. And so Jim and I have sort of have a bet, like, if it's ever going to stop. So far I haven't really seen a stop. It just seems to keep growing. There's, and a lot of it's general interests, and there's a lot of related kinds of products that have gotten sold. One downside I see is there's not really a market for a lot of the production. For all the printing that young people wanted, one of the questions people come to me with is related to an idea that was emerging. The phrase was, which was entrepreneurship, you know, being a small business person. And there is a distinction that I see between the past, where I would get more questions from people who clearly understood that they were probably getting into a hobby, an interest with devotion, And I think that what drives it isn't really a change in the world as much as economics. I mean, that's the change in the world and the hope and desire that we've given our young people. Maybe it was a mistake, you know, to think that they could turn what they loved into a job. Great goal, right? But I've been pretty discouraging almost always of any young person who comes to me and wants to start a business in letterpress printing. I haven't discouraged their love or any kind of sense of commitment that they had, but the reasons they love letterpress printing are almost always, when I ask any probing questions, have nothing to do with work or business or making a living. And the confusion of the two is disastrous. And letterpress printing, if taken seriously, means certainly a commitment of money, although I still think it's not that high a barrier for someone who's serious, but it's poundage, real weight, you know, a real space. You can't put a 2-ton printing press in a, you know, 1-year apartment rental. So those kinds of, the seriousness of what it is sometimes lost on people who are just getting in. And that's, I think I'm doing a favor if I kind of make somebody think twice about really what their goals are for starting a business. I have here that I wanted to talk about the death of the book discussion being related to the destruction of our card catalog. Should I talk about that a little bit? I know we don't have a lot of time, and I don't want to segue too much. But you know, people who work in the libraries, I mean, most of the ones I know and have had the privilege of working with are all doing wildly different things in terms of their subject area, since primarily I've worked with bibliographers. So it's not really that weird that somebody wouldn't know what I'm doing here. Since I don't read Latin, for instance, but I, you know, might know the Latinist or whoever's covering those subject areas, or have knowledge about all kinds of things that we don't know, and we trust them to put that forward in the world, you know. And I really love that. It's probably pretty old school. I see a trend in the libraries towards like Henry Ford automation. Like, we're all going to be the same. Anybody could fill in that job, right? We can all just step in and do the stuff. But I don't think that's really how... I don't think that's how a stellar institution really works. I'm sure at some level that's got to be true, right? We all need to fill out our payroll in the same way, or... we're all doing our own secretarial work and have forever. That's what we do. But I couldn't presume to do what you're doing right now. And that's why they pay you the big bucks, right? I just really love that amount of trust. And because my background's preservation and not... it's so funny because I think of myself of the libraries so much, and I think that that other people who are, say, selectors recognize that not everybody knows what they do. But there is an understanding, if you're a librarian, that you're among your own people with other librarians, and I have felt at times alienated from that. So some of my best colleagues haven't been necessarily librarians. Dan Joe or Don Johnson, editor and graphic designer. The people from LTG, I feel very sort of affiliated with, sort of support service, the digital content group. And so I think I feel like an outsider, but I don't mostly mind that if I think that my work is... if I'm allowed to do my work, right? If I can put it forward in the world and I'm trusted, those things that seem very basic to a university, maybe. How do I want to make this segue? Okay, yeah. So I think that I know a lot more, though, about librarians and libraries than librarians and libraries know about me, sort of. Does that make sense? Because my subject area is really outside, an outside thing. It's outside. And there have been many people that have welcomed me and worked with me and have some, you know, either I've had the chance to teach or learn or share what I do more, and that's been fabulous. Because my background's in preservation, one of the things that's happened here that's related to this whole death of the book thing and changes in libraries that I see as being a bad thing is that we destroyed our shelf list of cataloging cards for our library. And maybe it's the worst thing we'll ever do, and that would be good, because perhaps it's not, you know, it's gone, right? But sometimes I think it might be indicative of things are moving so fast, and it's very hard to make good decisions, and you're working with huge budgets here if you're directing a library like this. It's a research library, and I get that, that there's a lot of plates that are in the air all at once. But I think, as a research library, at a very large institution with a significant history for the libraries, I mean, of libraries supporting what happens here, that they need to take a long view. And I don't think the long view is thinking people don't need books and they're not going to need libraries. And I feel very defensive about anyone who is a professional in the libraries who would take that view. Because I'm sort of like, you get out of the army, you know? You just get out. Maybe you get an honorable discharge, but you're not doing your job. Preservation is part of that. It's not the only thing. But we have had a tendency at this institution not to really think about long view and preservation at the same time. Not really. Not deeply. We pay lip service to it because we know we have to and everybody else does everywhere else. We see when we look over their shoulders. Mm-hmm. And some places are doing a much better job. But we should be out in front, or at least not just on par. And being on par is getting rid of a written record that your staff kept for decades with notes that reflected, if nothing else, a slice of time up to a certain moment in the life of your institution. You do not want to have leaders who don't understand why that's significant. I know I'm right. I am not a librarian. Now, is it because I'm not a librarian, or they just didn't have the vision I have? I don't know, mm-hmm. but I think it's wrong. And it's the most wrong thing that's happened here to me, I would say. Not personal, not, you know, wasn't on my watch. I was there when they started. I mean, I knew that the main card catalogs were going, but I didn't know the shelf list was going. So, and I don't think anybody really knew because they did it very, very quickly. And that's another thing that's bad. You should never make a fast decision about something like that. I don't even know if they thought it was important. I really don't know. Mm-hmm. All right, that's the end of my piece. That's my little, that is my mm-hmm. protest against lack of vision in the libraries. But it could be, if someone was thoughtful, considered as a really bad moment that you wouldn't want to be caught repeating and have to think about, what would that mean? You know, where might I make a really an error that was critical? It wasn't that much they could have boxed that stuff up. It really could have been boxed. Mm-hmm. But it was self-destructive, I think. It really felt that way to me. Okay. All right.
So we have a few more minutes. And I know we've now we postponed the Silver Buckle Press, the transfer, the legacy, right. etc.
Do you want me to talk about those service pieces for a second?
I think if we finish with that service piece, then maybe we can start next time with 9/11, maybe a little bit about technology, although I think you really, in a sense, talked about technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might be good to talk about the website.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I have talked about technology a bit. I think I told you before that I think it's amusing. Am I interrupting you?
No.
Is that a good... So the Silver Buckle Press, we hard-coded a website and mounted it. I think we worked on it for a year, I bet, in 1997. I think we were one of the first separate library entities to have a website. It was a pretty big deal. Apple had given the libraries two Macs, and Peter Gorman's area had one, and the other one was at the Silver Weckle Press. I think nobody really knew what to do with them. Mm-hmm. So we got one, and ours was a staff public, but nobody ever came to use it. Nobody that I remember. Maybe Stephen Dask once might have came and used it. We had it for years. It was wonderful. It was wonderful to have that, you know, robust for graphics computer to work on. And a student I hired, Liz Roth, who's a faculty art member at Oklahoma now, did this great site for us. Angela Richardson, who's been in town and done a lot of different interesting things, an artist, made me as a volunteer for free. I didn't really know she was doing it. Two little animated films using typographic ornaments. And they were very sophisticated. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. So we sent out a postcard to let everybody know that we had a website, and it had the URL on it, which was, of course, so long. And the word Silver Buckle Press, of course, were buried at the end because the protocol then was never to, like, let anybody know what they were searching for or something. I can't remember. I'm sure there was a good reason at the time. And that was one of, I guess now, three different websites we had. But we also had a really wonderful online exhibit that was done of the Exquisite Horse and all things that were hard-coded by Liz and that I used to know a little bit about but haven't really done in a long time. The next was Dreamweaver. That's what everybody used when we did the next iteration. And now it's all done for you very poorly by WordPress. And everybody looks pretty much alike. And it's fairly boring, I would say, in the world. But that's changed everywhere. It's not just the libraries. But the world of the Internet was a more dynamic place, I would say, in many ways, despite having easier tools now to use. So that was the technology part I was going to mention. Mm-hmm. And in the library, I've had really great colleagues, and I think, incidentally, I've talked about them some. Many bibliographers, certainly Robin Ryder in Special Collections, Lynn Kerenick in the Art Library, Susan Baraboo, who's had many different roles here, Paloma Solis, I've worked with a lot over the years, and I'm proud to say that it was from looking in the library that I had first knew about Cordell's, and I think introduced them to Paloma, and then early on in her interest in working with Cartoneras, this first South American publishing activity that's now international, I really encouraged her, and we are now, I think, the place in the country for collecting and writing about those books, which are held in special collections, and it's due to Paloma's extraordinary work on them, and but I'm just happy that I was there at the beginning. And when they had a conference for Cartonera publishers here, I got to work with Paloma on the programming for that and organize with a student who was on staff at the time, and then also Jim Escalante in the art department, several activities that involved printing, day-long workshops that were going on with the people who came. And it was the first time most of the people involved in Cartonera publishing from many different countries in South America had had a chance to meet each other. So it happened here in Madison, Wisconsin. Then just for all of us to meet so many interesting people who were in publishing. It was great. A really good thing for the libraries. Puts us on the map, you know. I hope administrators know, you know, what kind of people they have here. Early on when I came to Madison, there were some cool groups, and some I participated in, some I served with. Before the Arts Institute, there was the Arts Consortium. So it grew out of this effort of faculty and staff to consolidate the power of loosely distributed arts organizations and activities on campus. And they have been so highly successful, it's really... Probably no one ever really thinks about the fact that the Arts Institute puts on a film festival or has this staff or just hired a director who came from Scotland. It started only because, I mean, it's there only because a lot of people had a really good and needful thing that they saw and that they worked their asses off to achieve on this campus. That really has changed the face of art activity here, literally, because it is about that putting that face out there, that perception. The work was going on already, but the enhanced kind of recognition or power that happened because they collectively worked to achieve it, that's a big change that everybody in the arts on campus who's worked on that over the years should be really proud. And I met some cool people working on those things in early days. I was by no means an instrumental person, but I was privileged to see what was happening and to be involved a little. There was a really wonderful group called the Material Culture Group that I think came out of the Historical Society. It was a curator there. He's not any longer, and I actually right now won't be able to tell you his name. And I hadn't been on staff very long, but it was a wonderful group of people because they weren't academics per se. They were curators mostly from all of the different galleries and kinds of collections, and it wasn't just UW campus, although it was by default mostly people who worked down here on campus, but there were Dave Driscoll from Historical Society, a curator, or I don't even remember now, filmmakers. It was a really cool group of people. I have to say, to my disappointment actually, that when Material Cultures as a program got set up at the university, there was a year or so of kind of trying to merge this old group of people who just got together and would talk about their work maybe once a month and meet a lot of interesting people with the academics who are coming in to take this over. And I don't fault the program people or the faculty, because they had their work to do. But the result was that this original group of people who'd been getting together actually folded. The person, I think, who'd been organizing it the most took a job somewhere else. But it was a really very lively, active group, and I take it as a model of something that can function really well, because it was mostly, certainly, academic staff instead of faculty. That's what I mean when not academic. I don't mean it wasn't scholarly, but it's a group of people who often don't have the opportunity, I think, outside of, especially the library, where almost all academic staff, to sort of meet colleagues in the world and have some creds in the public space among their people. I really liked that a lot. It was a good thing. In the libraries, I've served on some search and screen and GLS staff development committee. I actually haven't done a great deal of committee work in the library. I did a lot of work I sort of think of as service work for the library through my department, which was communications, for many years, and worked on all kinds of library publications and outreach and brochures and videotapes that never got shown that you'd spent hours working on, and, you know, changing direction from the director or whoever needed something to produce materials that showed off the libraries well. I used to think I really worked for the libraries, you know. That was a visible thing in the world that I represented, and I was very proud of it. I also served for several years on a statewide a committee called the Wisconsin Center for the Book, or Board of Directors, and that's a funny group. It's an affiliate of the Library of Congress. Every state has one. Most states are associated with a state library, which Wisconsin doesn't have, or an institution. And for many years, we were with the Academy, the Wisconsin Academy. But before I ever got involved, that group had spun off. So they had been spun off. So they were the only state center for the book, I think, that had no institutional affiliation. That's since changed. They're now affiliated with the Library School at the University of Milwaukee, UW-Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good change. And that happened while I was on the board, so I can say I did a good thing. But the coolest thing I got to do, the very coolest, was in 2011. I got to go to the every representative book center, state book center, sends someone, if they can, to the Library Mall during the National Book Festival, which I'd never been to. I didn't really know anything about, but they have this thing called Pavilion of the States. It's like the nerdiest, most wonderful bookish thing in the world. And it was during a year of a lot of Souris in the state of Wisconsin, 2011. And I got to take my husband and sit at a booth or stand at a booth on a very hot day on the mall with a sign over my head that said Wisconsin and give away books and materials about books that had been donated from extraordinary presses like the Historical Press. It was great books. And all of these people, I had no idea, who live in the D.C. area that come to this book festival, besides all the teachers that come, it's like an old home week or something, because all these people come up and they're looking for their stage booth, and then they come, and then you get to give them, if you have one, a little Wisconsin souvenir. I think we had Cheesehead erasers, which were very popular, and I think we bought on our own dime. You know, it's a brochure and then materials to give to media instructors. School librarians basically are the big users of this fair, and they're looking for bibliographies and checklists and anything they can get their hands on. And it was exciting to be, you know, in the Capitol and have people so hungry for what you had there. That was very exciting. I loved it. I just absolutely adored it. So it was a really hot day of handing out books and representing Wisconsin, a highlight though for service. Since before it opened, I've been involved with the Hamilton Wood Type and Printing Museum in Two Rivers, and it was an effort of their local state historical society to preserve some remnants of the production of wood type that had been made by the Hamilton Wood Type and Manufacturing Company in Two Rivers that started in the 1880s, I believe. That company, Hamilton, by World War I, was an international producer of more than wood type, which was how they started, of print room equipment and efficiency tools and standards that really changed the look of every print shop in the world. Mm-hmm. And they sit on a river and on the lake, and it was sort of this perfect place in the woods where you could get maple, which they needed to make cabinetry, and lots of people there for labor. So it was really the place, it was the place for Hamilton to start a business, and it was very successful. So the remnants of this company were being sold off, the remnants of that, the wood type part of that company, mm-hmm. which hadn't been active. And so this local historical society started a museum, and at the same time, I and a former student I was able to hire for a year here, Rachel Davis, we were working on a specimen book of our wood types, and it really dovetailed because we knew about Hamilton, and then we heard about this, and we went up and met the founder, Jim Van Lannen, and he gave us a behind-the-scenes tour, and my husband and I went back for the grand opening, and they had a high school band, and Tommy Thompson, the governor, was there to cut the ribbon. It was a big deal. Then kind of nothing happened for many years until around 2008 or 9. And I'll talk a little more about that next week. But one thing that happened in my career at the press is it started out with me thinking I was sort of helping them, and then not being as involved for a few years. Things were kind of slow up there, not too much going on. It was on my radar. I would tell people about it. And then one day, people started telling me about it. You know, 10 years or so into it, and this, if you ask anybody in Wisconsin who watches public television, they probably know about this place. There was, there've been a couple of films made. Mm-hmm. One was produced by Wisconsin Public Television, Small Town Stories, I think it's mm-hmm. called, covers them, and I got to work on that. I got to do that some editing for that, or help them as an advisor. But this bigger independent film that was made about Two Rivers, really called Typeface, though, kind of put the museum on the map. And it's become kind of the place in the country for people to go if they have any interest in wood type singularly, but in a larger way, sort of printing history things. So it's kind of fun to have gone from having them be what felt like a little sister or something to being like, I don't know, something else, a different family relationship. It's like the kid grew up, right?
I think we've
Is that
reached,
a good place?
Yeah. I know there might be a couple more things
That's
you want
right.
to say about services,
that was
but we can start with that maybe next time.
That was great.
All right. So this concludes interview number 3. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Troy.